Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. Today's show is going to be a little different. We're going to be talking about not so much what we're doing in our daily lives, although we'll end the show with that. But we're going to be talking about a big shift in the way we think about ourselves as human beings in the larger scheme of life. Today is Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014. And it's the autumn equinox. Now, some of you may have seen in your calendars a few days ago on the 21st, it said the first day of autumn. Well, actually, what the autumn equinox is the midpoint between the longest day of the year on summer solstice and the shortest day of the year on winter solstice. It happens on a very particular day when the sun is at a particular point in the sky. And that is determined by the position of the sun, not by a date on the calendar. And there's this whole way that time operates in nature, which is determined by the sun and the moon. And then we have this calendar, which is all about standardizing everything, making what's called a civil calendar that has nothing to do with the time that's going on in the natural world. And I bring this up today because it happens to be, well, I chose to do this show on this day. But it shows the difference between our industrial civil life and the world of nature. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about that difference and how we can like get ourselves realigned and why that's important. My guest today is Lier Keith. She was on last Tuesday. She's the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability, which has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. And last week we talked about the vegetarian diet, but this week we're going to be talking about some of those concepts that made her book the most important ecological book of this generation. I kind of got lost here. There's so much to talk about. Hi, Lier. Just let's say hello.
Hi, Deborah. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. So what I want to start with is I know in my life that there was a certain set of things that happened, and I want to tell my story about how I became aware of that I was part of the natural world in addition to being part of the industrial world, but I think it's more basic and fundamental that we are all part of the natural world. But I'm imagining that you, from reading your book, that you have some kind of similar story. So would you tell us about that moment that this shift occurred for you?
You know, I think for me it started when I was a really young child. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and we would make journeys north to go see my grandmother in Connecticut. And the other place that we went regularly was down the shore, so to the New Jersey coastline. And to get to either place, you had to drive along these absolutely horrible highways that are surrounded by this vast, you know, ugly, toxifying machine. I mean, it just goes on for miles and miles and miles. It's industrial wasteland. And to my 3-, 4-, 5-year-old mind, it was just the most horrifying thing. And I learned to just brace myself every time, you know, we were going on one of those trips because it meant an hour or two of just driving through. Eventually I read The Lord of the Rings and it was Mordor. I mean, to me, that's just what it was. Mm-hmm. And I knew that at the end of the journey, we'd be someplace really beautiful. So we'd either be at the ocean or we'd be at my grandmother's. And she lived across the street from this beautiful little river. And we were allowed to just play up and down the river all day. And to me, this was the most magical thing in the world, especially growing up in a more urban environment, to actually have running water and snakes and fish and, you know, waterfowl and trees. And just, it was as magical as it could get, but you first had to go through hell to get there. And I could not understand how it is that human beings had done this to the place that they lived. And I think this is one of the most motivating things in my life was to try to understand that. Why would people do this? To take this place that had obviously been so beautiful once and turn it into such just industrial hell. So that was, I think, just absolutely formative in my early years, was that disjuncture between the beauty of the wild places that were, you know, a tiny bit wild, but at least I had access to as a young kid, and then, you know, what was being done all around, and that was encroaching every year.
Yes, yes.
You know, there were less trees, and there was less wilderness at the beach, and fewer sand dunes, and you know, you could watch the life just shrink. And I felt the emergency of that, and so I think that just was very formative in my life. And I have now, as an adult, seen other small children have those kinds of reactions as well. So I know it's not just me. I think there's something in us as human beings, as actual animals.
Yeah.
Who need a home, you know, who love this place, who see the destruction. And, you know, now, of course, we're really up against the wall in terms of that destruction. But I think we do respond to that. We just learn to shut it off.
I think so, too. And I just want to add, coming from California, it's very different in California. So I think people listening in different places may not have a picture of what you've been describing. Because I know that I was shocked and horrified when I first came to the East Coast driving along a highway and seeing that industrial, like miles and miles and miles of factories and smokestacks and just really ugly, ugly industrialism just right there on the highway that is all in the Northeast, very much so. And I didn't have that in California. That's not the way the highways look. And so it really, I can imagine how you felt as a child. My story is that I had a different thing. A thing happened to me when I was an adult. And there was just, I woke up in the morning. I was living in San Francisco in the city in a studio apartment. And I woke up one morning and I said, I need to leave the city. I just knew inside of myself I needed to leave the city. And I went and I lived out in a forest about an hour north of San Francisco, just on the other side of a hill from the Pacific Ocean. It was had huge fir trees. It was a rural community. So I lived on a little street all surrounded by trees, but otherwise there was a few other little cabins like mine and animals. And, you know, the different wildflowers came out at different times of year. And it was just, you know, I could go out my front door in the summertime and pick wild blackberries. It was a very rural, close to nature kind of existence. And because that was so different from the existence of growing up in suburbia and then living in a city, I lived in San Francisco for quite a while. I lived there for 2 years, and there was this profound shift for me when I started seeing the ecosystem. When we live in a city, when we live in suburbia, there's no ecosystem anymore. But when you go actually out and live in a forest, you start understanding that there's animals and a change of seasons. And you see, I had a skylight over my bed, and so the moonlight would come in. And it was just so, so different that I started experiencing for myself that nature existed because I was living in it. Going camping for a weekend isn't enough. Going away for 2 weeks to Girl Scout camp wasn't enough. When I lived there in the forest for 2 years, it made a profound difference for me. And at the end of those 2 years, I like looked at this beautiful ecosystem, and I looked at suburbia and the city, and I said, wait a minute, there's something very, very wrong here, and that we are living this industrial life of having everything come from a factory and a store, and yet if you're actually in the ecosystem, you see that nature is sustaining life in a way that sustains life, and we humans have forgotten what that is. And so the first thing is just, we're going to talk about some other things, but the first thing is just to understand that we live in an industrial world, but there's this other world of nature, and we live within that too. Everything all the resources for every product we use all come from that, and it operates in a different way. And if we want to be sustainable, we need to find out what that is. And Liera and I have both done a lot in that regard, and we're going to talk more about that when we come back. I'm Deborah Lynn Tadd. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Lierre Keith. We're talking about nature and how the natural world is different from the industrial world. One of the things I wanted to say that I forgot to say when telling my story before is that the reason that I went out to live in the forest was because I was trying to escape toxic chemicals. I, you know, had been living in suburbia and especially in the city where there were a lot of toxic chemicals, not only in my home, but in the environment. And I thought, where is the cleanest place I can go? And I went to live in a forest. But what I found, even though I was just looking for clean air, what I found was that there was this whole natural world there that's just like, it's just like you step out of industrialism into this other world. And that's what we're talking about today, is this other world of nature, in which is the industrial world is within it. But as we put all our attention on the industrial world, we forget that nature is out there and it has its own rules. And in order for all of our whole culture and everything to survive, all of life to survive, we as human beings need to start understanding what those are. Excuse me. Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about, we mentioned it a little bit last week in talking with Lierre, is the fact that every life form survives by eating other life forms. Lierre, why don't you tell us something about that?
I am reminded of a quote by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was a feminist from the early 20th century, and she had this great quote where she said something like, you know, the Buddha looked out at the world and he said in horror, my God, they're all eating each other.
Yes.
And he declared it bad. But I look out of the world and I change one word and I say, they're all feeding each other and it's good. Mm-hmm. And that to me is, you know, the exact problem with things like, you know, veganism or, you know, this kind of the separation that we have right now living in an industrial world. We don't see those cycles. We don't understand how life physically works on this planet.
That's right.
And that's exactly it. You know, there's birth, there's growth, and then there's, you know, death and degeneration. And then at the end of that, there is regeneration. So everything that we are is recycled back into this process called life. So we are broken down into, you know, every last little molecule of carbon, whatever. It's all going to get recycled, taken out by other life forms, and life will continue. And that is what life is that cycle. And there's not really any way out of it, I mean, unless you want to decide that you don't want to live anymore. But your body will still be recycled even if, you know, you decide to knock it off. There's no way out. You know, like, that is just what happens on this planet. And you can decide it's a terrible thing, or you can decide that this is an incredible gift. And I decided that I would rather see it as a gift. And maybe that's, you know, kind of a discussion that's got a more spiritual base to it, but you know, this is your body is a piece of the universe that you've been given, and that's an amazing thing to have, right?
It is an amazing thing to have, and also our bodies. Well, we don't. Here's another thing that we don't see in the industrial world: like when our bodies die, then what happens is that they get preserved with formaldehyde and get put in a box and sit in a cemetery. If we were living out in the wild, or look at a native culture that's non-industrial, what would happen is that the bodies would get buried, or the people would just, like, I know some Native American cultures or native cultures around the world, when people get to the end of their lives, they just leave their tribe and they go walk out into the woods or wherever, and they lay their bodies down, and their bodies just, they biodegrade like anything else. And it goes back into the ecosystem, that the ecosystem feeds us, and then our bodies feed the ecosystem. But there's something else I want to mention about this too. There's a wonderful little book called Furtive Fauna, and it's all about our bodies being an ecosystem to other organisms. And when I read this book, there's so many things that little microorganisms that are living with us in our bodies, like there's a little microorganism that cleans the little stuff that gets caught in our eyelashes. It actually helps us survive. And the whole microorganism that we talk about, the flora and fauna in our guts, all those probiotics and everything, that's a whole culture of being little cells that are not our bodies. they're coexisting with us to help us digest our food, and there are all kinds of creatures in our bodies helping us exist. It's like we're an ecosystem. Our bodies are an ecosystem to other living things. And so it's all about this interconnection.
Yeah, about 10 pounds of our body is our organisms that are not us.
Yeah.
That's a lot. And also,
it is a lot.
If you do it, that's by weight, but if you do it by numbers, there may be as many as 9 times more non-human creatures in the human body than there are cells of you.
Yeah.
So you can lie there at night going, wow, well, what actually am I? You know, and most of those are very friendly. Sometimes the bad ones take over and, you know, you end up in a bad way. But most of them are doing things for us. You know, we provide them with a home, like you said. We're habitat, essentially. And they do all kinds of fun things for us. They help us digest our food, and they keep us healthy, and they're part of our, you know, immune system, and they keep our skin clean, and, you know, on and on. We can't see them, and we wouldn't even know they were there, but that is the case. You know, we do provide a home for these other creatures, and now we have these symbiotic relationships.
And that happens, you know, in layer after layer. It's all kind of nested in nature, these symbiotic relationships, as the systems get bigger and bigger and bigger. There's one other thing I want to mention with regards to this, too, and that is that I know that a lot of people don't want to do harm, and that motivates a lot of decisions. For me, the greatest thing, if you don't want to do harm, and I don't want to do harm, but I'm always looking to see what is the thing that can do the greatest good for life. And that's why I am so adamant about not using toxic chemicals, because to me, the greatest thing that causes the greatest harm across the greatest amount of life is to use toxic chemicals. And that, so I think that's a much bigger concern when you actually look at the harm being done than to be concerned about that we shouldn't feed our own lives because we're taking the life of something else. There's just, I mean, plants have feelings too. Plants know when they're being eaten. I mean, plants have been hooked up to machines that measure their emotional response. And anyway, we're getting to break. So we'll be right back and we'll talk more about this. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and we're talking about nature. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Liere Keith. She's the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice, and Sustainability, which has a lot about the vegetarian diet, but it's all based on the kinds of things that we're talking about today. She really has this understanding of how life works and how what we eat from an industrial viewpoint is so out of whack with nature. And she explains all this in the book. It was very interesting. You can go to Toxic Free Talk Radio and you'll find her book there. You can click on it and order it. You can also go to her website. And so the next thing I want us to talk about is when I read Liere's book when it first came out, I think it was in 2009, and it's full of scribbles and underlines and post-it notes and turning down pages. But when I opened it a couple weeks ago, when I invited her to be on the show, I had written one thing on the inside of the front cover, and that is, life produces food. And it's absolutely true. We don't need supermarkets. We don't need agriculture. We can just go outside and into an ecosystem. An ecosystem, it will always produce food to support all the living things that are in that ecosystem. It produces food for plants. It produces food for animals and produces food for humans. That's what life does. And here in Florida, I live in an area that has fairly old houses. My house was built in 1940. But every single person has old citrus trees. That's what people did then. It's like what they did was they planted citrus trees, and we all have so much grapefruits and oranges and tangerines and everything. We can't even eat them. We can't even give them to each other because we all have trees. And it's just wonderful. And nowadays, people plant ornamental plants instead of planting food. But as recently as 1940, what they were doing was planting foods in fig tree gardens and all of these things. So, Lear, talk to us about life-producing food.
So, pretty much in nature, everything, every action that every creature takes is going to provide food eventually for somebody else. And that's why it's really an interconnected web. You know, it's not a series of hierarchical relationships where we're exploiting each other. It's actually just a system of mutual feeding. So, for instance, you know, I live in Northern California now, and we still have some salmon runs. So the salmon come up the stream, you know, to spawn, and that's, you know, how they're continuing their species. But in the meantime, the bears and the eagles and all these, you know, what are called apex predators will feed on the fish. And by doing that, they actually take the nutrients from deep in the ocean that are in the salmon's bodies, and they keep themselves alive, they keep their babies alive, but they also distribute an incredible amount of resources, minerals and whatnot, back into the forest. And this is like this giant pump, essentially, of nutrients that go from ocean up the rivers and the fish and then out into the forest with the bears and the foxes and the eagles and keeps the forest healthy. Without those nutrients, the forest will eventually die. I mean, this is just inevitable because there's nothing else to feed trees this big. They need nutrients from the salmon, and it's the salmon that do that. But every step along the way, every creature involved is doing what it needs to survive, doing what it needs to feed its babies, and in the act of doing that, it's feeding the entire community. And that's the beauty of this, is that we are all in these interlocking, mutual, symbiotic relationships. If you step outside of it and you don't understand that, you think, oh, those terrible bears, they're killing fish. And that's not what's really going on. On a small level, yeah, but by doing that, they're not just increasing their own species, you know, feeding their babies, but they're feeding the forest. And because there's a forest, there are bears. And because there is a forest, there's actually a river that fish can live in. Because without those trees, the rivers are dead.
Right.
So in fact, you know, by the fish feeding the bears, feeding the forest, that feeds the river, which makes the salmon possible. So the salmon are feeding themselves. And you can look in any biological community, and you will see exactly that cycle, that flow of life to life to life to life around back, till it actually helps you to be part of that cycle. And a lot of us, we don't see it, we don't live in it, we don't understand it, our culture doesn't teach us about it, and we're left on our own as adults to try to figure out where has this all gone so wrong. Because we lack that really basic, that basic understanding that life is always feeding life.
I think that's exactly right, that our culture is not teaching us. I know that for myself, I had to go find this information. It's out there, but, you know, nobody told me to go find it. Nobody suggested that it was there. It was just me waking up one day and saying, I have to get out of the city and go live out in nature. I didn't know why I was doing that. I just knew deep inside of me that that's what I needed to do. And there I just looked around and I said, wait a minute, here's the model for life. It's not in the city. This is where we've gone wrong, is not understanding the basic fundamentals of life. And so what we do is we go and we cut down the trees and we make paper towels, and then the trees aren't there, and then there's not a river, and then there's not a salmon. And I've seen the salmon jump. I used to live in Northern California. And I mean, I could just go, I lived in the San Geronimo Valley, and there's a place there where they come up, in January, and you can just stand there on this little bridge and watch them jump up over the rocks. And it's a very cool thing to have right there where you live and have your community celebrate that. And that's not what I get in the city. That's not what I get in suburbia. But that's how we all should be living. That reconnects us as human beings to nature.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, the other thing is that the more disconnected we are as a culture, the more we lose sight of what's being lost every day. You know, the descriptions of what the salmon runs were like here, you could hear them coming for 24 hours. It sounded like thunder rolling. That's
wow.
How much noise the fish made, that's how many fish there were. And I've heard this description of rivers the world over, that once upon a time, you know, the rivers would be black and roiling with fish, you know, so dense with fish you could walk across the river on the backs of the fish. There's a description
like that. I've read
that
too, yeah.
From the west, from everywhere. that's how dense life was. And, you know, in a very short period of time, you know, we're reducing it all to desert. And I don't know what we think we're going to eat in 50 years or 100 years. The soil is gone. You know, the trees are gone. The animals are gone. You know, there's the soil is, you know, the planet's been skinned alive by agriculture. And I really, people need to start feeling the emergency of this while we still have time to turn it around.
I think so, too. I totally agree with that. That if you read these accounts of what nature was like earlier on, even 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and you think about the immensity of how long this planet has been here and the difference, how much we've lost. And there's so many things that we can do. We just need to decide to do those things. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about, Lier and I are both are going to talk about some things that we do in our own lives in this direction to consider nature and how to restore it rather than damaging it. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Lier Keith. She's the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Lier Keith. She's the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability. You can go to ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com and order her book, and also go to her website, which is there as well. So now knowing what you know about nature, what are some of the things that you do in your life to apply that?
So there's sort of two levels. One is that I really encourage people to get politically involved in whatever ways they're comfortable doing. Because honestly, we are up against some really vast, global, and very brutal systems of power that aren't going to give up without a fight. So not everybody has to be a frontline activist. A lot of people don't, you know, they don't have the personality for it, or they've got too much going on in their own lives. You've got children, you've got elderly parents. You know, it's just not going to work. But there's plenty of ways to get involved to help the people who can be on the front line doing those kinds of direct confrontations with power. And then behind the scenes, we really need to be creating an entirely new culture. And mm-hmm. that's going to take everybody getting involved. You know, we have to believe that democracy is possible. We have to believe that, you know, we can take our place again on this planet as animals who need a home rather than destroyers of that planet. And
right. So
it's pretty much every institution from the top on down we have to redo. And we have to redo them putting the earth first, putting those cycles of life before everything, because without them, we're all dead. And that has to be at the center, you know, of our spiritual practices, of our interactions with each other, of the ways we make political decisions. All of that has to come first. And we don't have a world that does that. What we have is a world that puts profit before anything else. And we also have a world that, you know, believes in those kinds of social hierarchies that are creating a lot of this problem. So, you know, we need to believe that a better world is possible and then get engaged. And then on a more personal level, there's things that we are all called to do that just express, you know, who we are as unique individuals. And for some people, that's teaching children. And for other people, perhaps it's making music or writing books or stories. And, you know, we're all going to have the things we do that just make us happy. And So whatever those things are for you, you know, try to center this idea that the earth matters and that we are dependent upon all of those relationships. That has to be, you know, have a biophilic worldview, you know, a worldview that that loves life and understands that at the center of whatever it is you're called to do. And so one of the things that is really important to me is just food and local food systems. And the reason that that's so important is it addresses so many multi-pronged problems all at once. So I know that when I'm buying from one of my local farmers who is engaged in what's called pasture-raised farming, so the cows are out on grass all the time, and the chickens follow the cows, and the ducks, you know, follow the cows. And, you know, so all the animals are in rotation, and they're moved very quickly off the grass. This is basically the way that you build topsoil. And by building topsoil, this is important because it's the number one way to sequester carbon. We all think of global warming as starting with the beginning of the industrial age, you know, when people start burning fossil fuel. That's not actually true. Global warming started when people started doing agriculture, because all of that carbon was in the ground, and when you do, in the soil, in fact. And so when you do agriculture, in fact, you're destroying all that soil, and that means it's coming to pieces and turning back into carbon, being released into the air. And it's true that industrialization has been an incredible accelerant for this destructive process. The beginning of it is actually agriculture. So, I mean, this is a lot of information to pack into 2 minutes here, but
yes.
to have farming that's based on actually using grass, using pasture land, is the reverse of that, because you are, in fact, repairing that ecosystem by leaving the perennial cover in place, so the grasses
yes.
are always in place, and they're sucking carbon out of the air, and that's what they do when they do photosynthesis, and it's all getting stored in the ground. In fact, a lot of the figures show that if we were to do this appropriately around the world, we could actually sequester all of the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age in about 15 years. And to me, that's really the only hope that we've got. That's it. We have to repair those grasslands. And what's destroyed those grasslands is agriculture. So that's the primary wound. That's where people went off the rails, was when they took over entire biotic communities, destroyed the perennial cover, took down the trees, plowed up the prairie, and then just used them for human use. So you're sending all those other species into extinction because they've got nowhere to live. You're destroying all the local waterways because all that soil just runs off into the water. Now the fish have nowhere to go either. They're all being killed. You're sucking up water from the water table underneath, ultimately turning what's left of the soil into salt. You know, the salinization that you see everywhere around the planet, that's kind of inevitable with agriculture. And ultimately, all that carbon's being released. So this is a destructive process from beginning to end. And, you know, when I was a vegan, I thought I was eating the right food, but I had no idea that agriculture was, in fact, this inherently destructive process. So by reversing that, by replanting, you know, those perennial species and, you know, repairing the grasslands and the prairies, and then you can eat food from inside an actual living community. So rather than imposing ourselves across it and just growing corn or wheat or soy, you're actually participating in the life of that land. So the carbon's being sequestered, topsoil is growing every year instead of being destroyed. All those plants now have a place to live again, and in a functioning prairie, 1 square meter should have about 25 different plants. So all that biodiversity comes back. You will instantly see birds, butterflies, insects, small mammals, amphibians. It creates little tiny mini wetlands everywhere if you do this right. So all this life comes back instantly. I've seen places where it's been 100 years since they had the birds. And all of a sudden, within 2 years, there are birds nesting everywhere that nobody has seen in literally over a century because it was destroyed by agriculture. They had nowhere to live. And the moment you give them a place to come back to, they will, because they want to live. And you can be part of that repair by simply supporting the farmers who are doing this well. So I buy, you know, most of my food comes from those kinds of farms. So I'm helping repair the planet. I'm helping a whole bunch of animals have really great lives. You know, all those, the amphibians, you know, all the way up to, you know, if they do it well, they can live with the large predators as well. So everybody gets to come home again. You get to repair the water. You get to restore the water table. You get to sequester the carbon. And you're also helping one of your neighbors be able to earn a living. And this is important. So instead of giving all your money to, you know, these corporate robber barons who are essentially gutting the planet for their profit, you're actually giving money to a local person, you know, who, you know, needs to repair the roof and send kids to college and do all that. Now you're circulating your money in a local economy. So you're helping to rebuild a set of relationships for humans that are way more based on justice rather than exploitation as well. You can do all of that by simply buying local food from grass-based farms. On top of it, it's really the best food for humans. This meets the amino acid profile that we need, the fatty acid profile that we need. It's really perfect food. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because we evolved on the savannas of Africa eating exactly that, these, you know, large grass-fed herbivores. So this is, in fact, the perfect food for humans as well. So you can do all of that by something really simple, which is just buying food from local grass-based farmers. And the best website for this is run by Joe Robinson, and it's called eatwild.com. And
wonderful,
she has a
website.
Directory, yeah. And you can just find all the farms, you know, in your area that are doing this right. You may have to travel a little bit, but it's worth it. And you get a big freezer, or you learn how to smoke it and dry it, whatever you're going to do. But this is, you know, you can find it actually at this point pretty easily. Encourage your local co-op, your local food store to carry this stuff. That's another political step you can take. And then get involved with other people in your area who also believe in this kind of local, sustainable, humane, and appropriate human nutrition. like the Weston Price Foundation. That's a great group. There's other groups as well. But this is just something I really care about because, you know, with one seemingly small act, you're actually affecting all of this stuff. And honestly, I think the most important thing is, like what you're doing, you know, having a radio show, you're getting the word out to other people. Talking to everyone in your life, you know, teaching your children a better set of values, talking to, you know, anybody else on your street, your neighbors, your friends, why this is so important, and, you know, conveying the emergency of the situation, because we don't actually have a lot of time left before we reach those tipping points on the planet. And, you know, if you love anything, it's really time to step up to the plate and do what you can to save it.
I completely agree. And you, one of the things that I think is so most fundamental that I like about your approach is that it's very restorative. Everything that you're talking about is not about saying, I'm not going to do this. You're not saying, I'm going to boycott factory farming, so I'm not going to eat meat. You're saying, how can I do the thing that is the best thing to restore life as a whole? And when that's the question that is asked, then you come up with all these kinds of creative, restorative things to do. You see what the solution is. And that's always been at the basis of my work as well, that how can we, certainly I'm telling people don't use toxic chemicals, but that's not the end of the story. The other part of it is to, instead of using toxic chemicals, that you do the thing that's restorative. And so always in my work, I have been talking about, you know, here's a less toxic product that you could use, an industrial product, but I'm certainly reaching out into the realm of artisans making things in their local ecosystems, because that's the sustainable model that is going to save everything. That Lierre's talking about it with food, I'm talking about it with products. Lots of people in the world are understanding this more and more, and that's really the direction that we need to go. That's the end of the show. We've only got 15 seconds left, so thank you so much, Lierre. And
thank you for all your work.
You're welcome. Thank you for all your work. We'll just admire each other. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and you can go to ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com and listen to all the past shows. You can listen to this one again. We've got to go. Be well. Bye.